An investigation has found that many Google services are tracking your location, even when you turn off location in your privacy settings. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, analysis of the latest tech news in our regular series, You, Me, and the Machine. I'll talk with cybersecurity expert Doug Jacobson of Iowa State University about how tech companies use your location data. Also, Jennifer Granick of the ACLU on what the courts have said concerning the privacy of historical cell phone location records. And are Iowa's voter rolls and voting machines safe from hacking? We'll hear from Linn County Auditor Joel Miller. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, another in our new regular series, occasionally on the River to River, You, Me, and the Machine. Let's just call it that for now. Every couple of months or so, we focus on some tech news in the headlines, a collection of different headlines that you and I have been hearing about. In order to go beyond the headlines this hour, we want to get some analysis and answer any questions you might have. Today, we're going to be focusing largely on technology and security. Later in the hour, are Iowa's voter rolls and voting machines safe from hacking? And also, we'll check in with Jennifer Granick of the ACLU on what courts have said concerning the privacy of historical cell phone location records. But first, let's crunch a bit of tech news with Doug Jacobson, Director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University in our AIM studio. Welcome back to the program, Doug.
Yeah, Ben, thanks.
I want to talk about Google making headlines last week in that Associated Press investigation, but I wanted to see what thoughts you had on the news that broke overnight, Doug, that Microsoft saying the Russian operation has targeted U.S. conservative groups. Fancy Bear is the hacker group that this one of the many names it goes by. So it executed a court order to disrupt these six fraudulent websites targeting some Republican conservative websites that had turned against this administration. What do you see going on here?
Well, first of all, this idea of taking domain names that are really close to something else has been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, in the early days of the internet, the famous one was whitehouse.com, was a porn site. So what we're seeing now, of course, is something a little different, is who the actors are. This idea that it's state sponsored is something that's, you know, this used to be or still is used a lot by individual hacker groups or hackers that are interested in money, login credentials, et cetera. But this idea of getting a bunch of domain names from a state-sponsored group and then using phishing to drive the legitimate users to these sites is a little different wrinkle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. We'll have to watch our midterms just over 2 months away. So I guess the question here is, and I don't know if this is a question for you, does it look like we're better able to protect ourselves from meddling this time from any outside forces?
Well, I think we're a little more aware of it. So maybe, hopefully we're more prepared. I think it caught us off guard in the last election that there was such an organized campaign to spread misinformation and to basically a propaganda campaign. And so I think we're now aware of it. So hopefully we can, as with Microsoft is doing, put a stop to these before they get too much traction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to some other tech news to get your thoughts. Doug Jacobson, Director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University. Want to reach out to our listeners. Your questions concerning technology and security this hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So, Doug, last week we had Google making headlines after an Associated Press report finding that the company is still tracking your location even after you turn off location services. Now, you go into your settings in your iPhone or your Android, and you have that as a setting. You can turn that off, or so we think. Describe what's going on here.
First of all, your phone always knows where it's at. So this, you may, the idea of turning off location settings is really more of the idea of turning off the notification back to place like Google. This, you know, it was a little surprising that Google was still doing it. And part of the question really comes as to why and what sort of information did they gather? For example, when we all use the Google driving app, it's miraculous, right? You're driving down the road and up ahead, you see the segment of road turn red. Well, it's not because Google has a camera there. It's because Google is monitoring the moving progress of all the phones. So, again, having not knowing exactly what information Google was trying to collect, there are some benefits to having sort of this crowdsourced location data, as long as they don't do attribution back to, hey, it's me stuck in traffic versus there's a phone not moving.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have these benefits, location services. We can see ads. We can see all kinds of things. Google Maps, one thing that you notice, it's a miraculous a tool for us to get around. I mean, who uses a fold-out map anymore, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you go in, you turn off location services, Google, but what did they collect and what did they use it for as far as you can tell?
I think it is for things like the phone or like the maps. It, there's the issue of your apps using location. So you bring up Yelp or any one of a number of apps that likes to know where you're at. This appeared to be inherent inside the Google phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that is going to be more of things that's going to benefit like the mapping service, but Google hasn't been very forthcoming about exactly what they're collecting.
What do you think are the repercussions of this story coming out and not showing Google in a very good light?
It's gonna bring some distrust. And I think if they, for example, if it was for aiding and driving, I think if they were out front and said, hey, while you're driving, the phone's gonna tell us your relative movement rates and so on, but we don't do attribution, et cetera. I think everybody go, okay, that's cool. It mm-hmm. benefits the collective. But this idea of just blindly collecting data without telling us is really disturbing. And it's not just, Google. I mean, this is things that we hear about off and on throughout the last, 10 years or so of sort of tracking or collecting information without us knowing.
Yeah, a few months ago we talked a lot about the European Union being ahead of us in terms of privacy protection, data protection. Presumably they have apps on their phones in Europe that work just as well for telling us when there's construction or a traffic jam just ahead of us. So I don't know if a greater, a more stringent privacy regulation helps.
Well, yeah, and again the European Union rules were all about attribution back to individuals. So I'm not even sure it would cover just raw data with no identifying attribution back to your phone. So yeah, it's that may be the loophole in this whole thing, because you're right. If it did send back attribution information, then they would be potentially in violation of the new European Union rules.
Let's talk a little bit about here the Iowa DOD, the Department of, the DOD, the Department of Defense came out with a recommendation that all this location information should be disabled. Explain that a bit.
Yeah. So there was an interesting story about 2-3 months ago where people were using an app like Strava and uploading their running. The running routes, right? Anybody who's a runner mm-hmm. uploads all their running routes. And they were able to look at certain areas in the country where they knew a military base was, and everybody running around the military base, in essence, outlined where all the roads were and all the buildings. So you ended up with a map of some classified facilities based on all these people running.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, that's an unintended consequence of collecting all this data. So, and likewise, troop movements or any of those sorts of things would be something the DOD would be very leery of.
Did we know that those were tapped into? I suppose, you know, if it's just innocuous jogging information, it wouldn't be especially protected, would it?
No, it wouldn't. And apps like Strava and others, you know, people post they're jogging, and you can look at what other people run. So, you know, it's just one of these things that nobody really thought about it until it's like, oh, wow, look what I can see.
Right, right. Okay. What about you, Doug? I mean, what would you recommend in terms of location services? Do you have your location data turned off on your phone?
No, I don't. So I may not be a good example. No.
Well, what is your thinking there? What thinking went into not turning it off?
Well, the apps I use, I like that I use want to know location data, and so I tend to like those apps that know where I'm at. A few of them I won't turn on. But I also like the fact that my phone knows where I'm at as far as driving. It will wake up and tell me if there's something, some driving problem ahead. So a little bit of it is the geeky in me as far as the driving apps and, weather, I shouldn't say this, but I have like 4 weather apps on my phone.
Okay. You qualify as a geek. That's fine.
And they all know where I'm at. So they will tell me when there's a lightning strike nearby, and they'll tell me when rain's coming. And as a geek, that's pretty cool. to have my phone, my wife thinks I'm a little crazy, but that's
The benefits, it sounds like you're telling me the benefits outweigh any sort of wariness you have about how that data may be used, your location.
Yeah, I'm not overly concerned about and many of those apps. Again, it's more of again, I'm hoping there's no attribution as far as me, being me at this location.
You're just a data point that's unnamed.
Yes, I'm hoping that's the case. Now, I did not, for example, get into the Pokemon Go issue where you create an account and you, in essence, telling this large company your exact location 24/7 as you were playing Pokemon Go. To me, that kind of crossed the line of being, a little too much information they were gathering on me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Doug Jacobson is with us, Director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University, talking about security and technology. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk with Linn County Auditor Joel Miller. He's just back from a hacking conference in Las Vegas. We'll be eager to hear about his reflections, what he found out at that hacking conference. Doug, this week we learned the FBI has warned banks in the United States of an impending cybercrime. This is something, I guess, by reading it, hasn't happened yet. A heist in the works called ATM Cash Out. What is it?
So it's really a high-tech bank robbery. The attackers gain access to the bank and are able to then reprogram credit or withdrawal limits on ATM cards. They're able to get the ATM card information from the consumers, and then they go reprogram a bunch of, typically you go out and get gift cards, and you reprogram the gift card to be have the ATM information on it. And then they do a simultaneous massive withdrawal. So a large number of them will go to ATMs, and at midnight they will insert the cards, and in essence empty the ATM machine. So it's a highly distributed bank robbery.
Hmm. And this has happened?
There was a bank that had this happen. I can't remember the exact dollar. I think the FBI report said the exact dollar amount that was taken. I think the FBI has caught wind of this potentially happening again. I mean, if they knew which bank it was, they would obviously have talked to the bank and got this stopped. So I think part of this news coming out is to get the banks to check their internal security and see if somebody has gotten into their systems.
Right, and to put the alert up, people's antenna up at banks to say, be on the lookout for this. And there would be some kind of footprints or little probes that you could recognize something like this in the works?
Yeah, there would potentially be some footprints, probes. You would also want to go in and make sure that that your credit limits haven't been overwritten. So there's some signs that they could look for, and unauthorized access or access by people at weird times.
I'm assuming that if this would happen en masse from my bank or something like that, 30, 40, 50 different cards or money is lifted this way in this ATM cash out scheme, that I am not on the hook, even if it's my account that gets drained to a certain extent?
Yeah, it'd be just like if somebody went down and with a gun and robbed your local bank and took all the money out of it. That was your money. I mean, they're not gonna hold you accountable for it. So,
How is this different, Doug, than the news we heard not too long ago that devices, and I'm not sure that the name that this scheme goes by, devices attached to the ATMs record your PIN number.
So those are skimmers. They sit on ATMs. They sit on gas station pumps. Those will target your individual account. So that will grab your information off of the card, and through some sort of video surveillance, they will get you as you type in your PIN number. And then now they have everything they need to become you and take the money directly from you. So that's the equivalent of robbing you as you walk down the street.
Okay, so we've got the cyber equivalent of robbing a bank, cyber equivalent of a hold up in broad daylight.
Yep.
Security literacy. This is something interesting that you've been dealing with there at ISU as well. What is it and how is it becoming increasingly important? We need to all develop. It sounds like what we're talking about today is security literacy.
And the idea behind literacy is the same idea we have behind financial literacy and other types of literacy is giving people enough understanding that they can internalize the issues or internalize what's going on, and then hopefully extrapolate. We can sit here today and give you a list of the top 10 things you should or shouldn't do in cybersecurity, but those threats change constantly. The attacks, the things we see today, are things we didn't see several years ago. And so by teaching people some of the core ideas behind cyber and behind cybersecurity, the hope is that they can be prepared as the attackers adapt.
Mm-hmm. And do you have some of those core ideas to list off that you would expect everyone using an electronic device should know?
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole idea of passwords, we spend a lot of time talking about passwords, but we need to spend more time talking about what they do, what they don't do, how they protect you. The idea of email, how email is used, how things happen in email, the whole phishing, spear phishing, mm-hmm. What to expect when you see email. And then web is another place where we need to educate people about, websites and how, like with this case with the Russians, how, we can get domain names that look very much like other domain names, and really giving them those tools that let them be more cautious and more aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned passwords. Very popular are these apps or websites where you have one password that unlocks all of your passwords because, passwords are such a hassle. You have 20, 30, 40, 50, some people have. Do you recommend any sites or do you use a site that unlocks all your passwords for all your apps on your phone, for instance?
I have a piece of software that I have that keeps my passwords. It's 1Pass, but there's several of them out there. There's web-based ones.
Mm-hmm. What is the name of the one you use, if I can ask?
It's 1Pass.
1Pass. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, like I said, there's numerous of those out there.
What convinced you to go with 1Pass? And I assume some others are like this. Is it has to do with the level of encryption?
No. just one that I picked, I guess. It's probably a little more techy than some of the other ones. The web-based ones are a little easier to access. This one, the password file that contains all my passwords is in my possession. And so I put it up on the cloud. And it itself, as you mentioned, is password protected. So it's a little less convenient as far as me using it in various places. Now, I don't use my, we talked earlier about my phone and location things. I do not use my phone for anything other than it's a phone. I text, I get the weather, and I use it to drive.
You don't do bank transfers and so forth.
I do not use my phone for any sort of authenticated transactions at all. First of all, it's a phone and it's little and the keyboard's tiny and so part of it's my age.
Okay.
I want a real keyboard.
Okay.
So I use a password manager that's really built much more for the PC Mac sort of world than it is the mobile world. But I encourage people to use something, whatever you feel most comfortable with. Cause as you mentioned, people have dozens and dozens of passwords,
yep.
if not hundreds. I can't remember 3/4 of them. So you end up making them all the same
We have a couple minutes left. Perhaps you can just describe something else in our news that's been happening in terms of a fraud here. The SIM card swaps. Very scary here. The SIM cards are found in each of our cell phones, right?
Yep.
And what is a SIM card swap?
Well, so the SIM card is basically your phone's identity. So it identifies your phone to AT&T, Verizon, et cetera. When you go activate a phone and the dude at the cell phone store, goes back somewhere and magic happens and all of a sudden you have a phone with a phone number.
Poof, it gets switched or you get a new phone. Yeah.
You get a new phone, and all of a sudden everything moved. He went in and reprogrammed the SIM card and told AT&T, Verizon, whoever, that now this SIM card, this phone, and its identity now maps to this telephone number. And that's something that is reprogrammed by the carrier. And so if you walk into a carrier and they don't have good authentication, you can convince the carrier, hey, this is, I'm going to buy a phone. And by the way, I want you to move this number to it. And by the way, that number happens to be not mine. But if they don't check it, they'll...
And poof, your mobile identity has been transferred to someone else and they can upend your life.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, basically.
So we have to go to a break here. We'll have you back in the second half hour. But in a short way, how do you avoid this? You make sure
there's a PIN, some sort of second identifier that identifies you uniquely to the carrier. I mean, Verizon requires one, and several other carriers let you do that.
Okay, we'll be back with Doug Jacobson, Director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University. And Doug will be with us as well as Jennifer Granick of the ACLU. She'll talk about what courts have been saying concerning the privacy of historical cell phone location records on your cell phone, on everyone's cell phone. Also, we'll hear from Linn County Auditor Joel Miller. He's just back from a hacking conference in Las Vegas. Amazing things he witnessed there. You'll want to stay tuned. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, tomorrow, Wednesday, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa will be joining us. Rachel Caulfield as well of Drake University. So much to chew over. Looks like the Manafort case, the jury there appears to be getting closer to a verdict, maybe even by tomorrow showtime. We'll talk about it in any case. More developments, of course, in the Russia probe as well tomorrow on River to River. Politics Wednesday. Today, we're talking about technology and security. Another in our series, You, Me, and the Machine. Doug Jacobson is with us, director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University, chewing over some recent news headlines, news stories that have to do with technology and security. In fact, we talked about Google making headlines after the Associated Press finding that the company still tracks your location even after you turn that off in your settings on your phone. A few other things. Let's talk with Jennifer Granick as well. She's a Surveillance and Cybersecurity Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
We wanted to tackle this topic a little bit from a legal angle and talk about a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case concerning the privacy of historical cell phone location records, Carpenter v. United States. Tell us a little bit about this case.
Well, the case involved an investigation of some robberies, armed robberies, and the police used cell phone records from phone providers to try to place particular people's handsets near the robberies. And so what they did was they got, 100 days, 165 days worth of location data from people's phones, and they used that information to place the defendant at or near the scene of several different robberies. So the question in the case was, this very novel police capability, which is to go back in time and figure out where people were, which is something that you could never really do in the olden days before this technology. And the question before the court was, is this the kind of information that police can access, for any reason or for no reason, or do they need to actually have probable cause as a warrant requires? In other words, you go to a judge and you prove you have a real reason to ask for it.
Right. So it'd be similar to like if you had your records in your home on a, in the olden days, you'd have maybe a piece of paper and you wrote down, let's say, everywhere you went and the route you took. If that's in your home, the police need a warrant to get into your home to access that, right?
Right, absolutely.
But
the question here, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but this is, I'm just trying to sort of equate this with things we've had in the past since this is completely new. So that essential map of where you were anytime is in your phone.
It is, and it's in the possession of the phone company. So when your mobile phone connects to a tower to make a call, to send a text, maybe when it registers with the tower to say, I'm over here in case you want to route me a call, the phone providers keep that information. And so you as a police officer can go to the, your Verizon, your AT&T, and say, okay, can you give us records for this particular phone? And they can go back as long as they keep the records for, which is something that we never really did before. So the question was really, is this novel capability of tracking somebody 24/7, going back into the past to find out where they were, is that just like trailing them, when you put a police officer in a van and follow people around, or is that something novel that requires a warrant? And the government's argument was, well, you've already revealed this data to the phone company, and so it's not really private anymore because the phone company has it. But the court didn't buy that argument. The court, basically said this type of tracking capability, this type of surveillance is really quite novel, and it can be incredibly invasive. There's really no way you can actually avoid it, and so we're going to require police to get a warrant before they do it.
Mm-hmm. It was a close decision, though, right?
It was. It was a 5-4 decision, but, I think that if you look at Gorsuch's dissent, he very much expressed some thoughts there that weren't completely antithetical to the majority's ruling. So it was 5-4, but I think that, technically, but I think that there was a lot of sympathy for the position that privacy rights really do need to evolve for the digital age and that, really there's sort of a 6-3 agreement on that. And, we'll see what happens with Justice Kennedy retiring.
Mm-hmm. So with this decision, what are the implications that now law enforcement, according to this decision, and is this a 2018 decision?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That law enforcement has to get a warrant to use this information. Implications there that you see?
Well, the implications are potentially huge, despite the fact that Chief Justice Roberts, in writing the opinion, said, we're really just dealing with this particular type of historical phone tracking information. I mean, it clearly has implications for other technologies. In modern times, almost everything we do is in the hands of third parties. Our most private conversations, our location, our health data, our financial data. And so, you know, under the government's theory and the way that, you know, investigators have been acting, all of this stuff is, you don't need a warrant for, it's not protected by the Fourth Amendment. But what the court is saying is, look, you've got to have a much more nuanced approach here. You can't just say, oh, third parties have it, so it's a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. And so now we're looking at real-time location tracking, search histories, web browsing, of course, email, which the you know majority of the court justices have said, you know, that's covered by the Fourth Amendment, even though it wasn't like an official ruling. Health data, information from smart meters inside your home. So there's all this other kind of information that's out there that now, you know, may be protected by the Fourth Amendment and something that officers have to have a good reason for that's supervised by a judge.
Right. And to remind everyone, the Fourth Amendment is something that protects us in our Constitution, people, their houses, their effects, so that there are not unreasonable searches and seizures, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. My favorite amendment.
All right. Jennifer Granick is with us, Surveillance and Cybersecurity Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. We have you for a few more minutes, Jennifer. Tell us about some other related issues you see here when we have this data, cell phone technology, and security out there that the ACLU is dealing with. It's on your radar.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're looking at certainly is with the amount of data that's generated by people these days is, you know, what are the legal protections for it? You know, we've been pushing for the Fourth Amendment to protect some of this information that's otherwise, you know, readily available. We have a series of cases we're doing about border searches as well. You know, many people, when they travel across the border, they have cell phones, they have laptops, you know, whether you're a business traveler or not. And traditionally, border security agents have searched this kind of information for no reason, and that puts trade secrets at risk as well as private information. So we have the series of cases seeking to impose, you know, some standards for when officers can look at your laptop and your phone when you're traveling internationally, so it's not just a fishing expedition. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's another set of cases that are very important, which is about what can you do technologically to protect yourself, not just from suspicionless government surveillance, but also from identity thieves and criminals and the sort. And these series of issues have to do with encryption, which is a technology that is required to protect your communications and your private data, but which also can thwart law enforcement's ability to collect information in an investigation. And there's a battle going on legally over what rights people have to use secure encryption, you know, even where it might interfere with police surveillance.
Real quick before we go, Jennifer, because I'm wearing one on my wrist, mainly it prompts me to ask you about Fitbits and all these other monitors we have on our bodies now that, you know, to keep ourselves healthy. I don't know if you have one.
I've used one for sure. My phone tracks this for me. So I may be cautionary about the privacy issues here, but a lot of that is because I love the technology as much as anyone.
Okay, so where does that overlap, the health Fitbits and so forth, overlap with our civil liberties?
Well, that's a great issue that I think the Carpenter case brings up, which is as you have these, you know, for healthcare providers, there's a law called HIPAA, which has some privacy protections in it. But, you know, the Fitbit company and a lot of these other companies are not healthcare providers. So the issue there is, you know, can the government look at this information without a warrant? And, you know, there's been some interest in it may seem irrelevant to people, but there's been some interest in looking at health data, like, you know, was somebody's heart rate elevated at a time that they were suspected of altercation or a murder or, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not really that hypothetical. And so there is some interest in looking at that information. Certainly you can imagine, you know, looking at health information to see if somebody violated their probation by taking drugs or, you know, fighting or something like that. So I think the Carpenter case suggests that this intimate data about our very bodies may also require you know, some kind of cause, probable cause, and a warrant before you can search it.
Mm-hmm. Very quick. This is so fascinating. I'd have to have a comment, Jennifer, while I have you here. You know, you can go down the street now and use your phone to recognize faces. Facial recognition software is with us and getting better and better. What are the implications there for our civil liberties?
Well, that's a huge one because, you know, a lot of our privacy in public has just default been because, you know, there's nobody is going to watch you all the time and recognize you. But with cameras that are outfitted with facial surveillance technology, you know, that all could change and you'd really be tracked all the time. So that's a privacy disaster, an Orwellian privacy disaster. And I think that, you know, we're nowhere near any ability to deploy this technology safely. Some of my colleagues at the ACLU of Northern California got a facial recognition technology that was sold by Amazon, and they ran the faces of the U.S. Congress through it
yes.
to see if they matched with mugshots. And I don't remember the exact percentages, but it was, you know, something around 20% or more of Congress matched as potential people who having previous arrest records, which is wrong.
Right, and I think it included at least one congressman from Iowa. I won't name him. and it is a misidentification anyway, right?
Absolutely, yes. And so, and then there was also the it showed that there was a disproportionate mistakes were made for members of the Congressional Black Caucus. So you have this technology that is biased and inaccurate, and it really is not ready for prime time. It's not ready to be deployed in any kind of sensitive circumstances.
Something tells me we're going to want to talk with you again in the future, Jennifer Granick.
I love Iowa. I'd be happy to come back.
All right. Survey and Cybersecurity Council with the American Civil Liberties Union. Jennifer, thank you for your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, doing some analysis of tech news. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100, specifically on technology and security. And right now we want to dive into elections, just over 2 months away from our midterms. Joel Miller is joining me now, Linn County Auditor, and he's just back from a hacking conference. Yes, there are such things in Las Vegas. Hi, Joel.
How are you?
I'm fine. First of all, before we get to DEF CON, which is the name of this hacking conference, be clear and tell us, what does the county auditor have to do with our elections?
Well, the county auditors in Iowa run the elections. Our secondary title is Commissioner of Elections. So 99 county auditors at the local level are the people who actually administer the local, state, and federal elections across Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So you visited something called DEF CON. What was it?
Well, as you said, it was a hackers conference, and I think 20 to 25,000 people were there. There were a lot of there were actually hands-on exercises. There was primarily what I went for was the voting machine hacking village, but there were things on you know, basically lock picking. There was things on how to looking at the seals that we also use on voting machines. Lots of information. Just it was overwhelming how much information was there and how many people were there talking about different topics.
I see the story of a that can stoke concerns about security ahead of our midterms. During the hackers' convention, I'm reading from a report, an 11-year-old boy managed to hack into a replica of Florida's election results website in 10 minutes, changing names and tallies. He was the quickest of 35 children. These children, ages 6 to 17, all eventually hacked into copies of the websites of six swing states during this conference over the weekend. Wow, Joel, I don't feel good about that. What about you?
Well, you have to remember those are unofficial results. Nevertheless, that would cause chaos if we displayed the wrong results. It seems after every election, we're in a race to get those election results up there, and I think people forget that those are unofficial results. The official results are actually canvassed through a process a week later.
What does that mean? What does that mean, canvassed?
Well, canvass is an old term, but it basically means audited by the boards of supervisors in the 99 counties. They basically compare the numbers from the machines against the overall tally to ensure that the numbers are the same.
And are they matching them up with paper, which presumably can't be changed?
Yes, they're matching them up against the paper that came out of the voting machines against the tabulating machine, which has the overall results. So that's the process. Obviously, Iowa has been using paper ballots since June of 2008, and we have that backup copy if anyone wants to request a recount.
Mm-hmm. And it would be dangerous to get rid of that paper backup.
We should not do that, at least in my lifetime.
Okay. Joel, so with this backdrop, all the things that you learned at this hacking conference, give us your read as Linn County's auditor in charge of elections in Linn County. What do you see currently as the biggest threats to our voting integrity here in Iowa?
Well, I've been talking about this for quite a while, and that is that the voter registration system is our biggest vulnerability. And I have talked about that with the Secretary of State, the Office of Chief Information Officer for Iowa, various individuals, my peers, and that was confirmed for me at DEF CON as well, that David Sanger, the author who just wrote a book, released a book called The Perfect Weapon, also confirmed that. But I'd heard it from other DHS officials, lots of other people. So it was a confirmation. And Iowa's vulnerable because not all the counties in Iowa are being monitored by the Security Operations Center, which is a part of the state. And that leads a question as to what the vulnerability is, since every county is connected to the statewide voter registration system.
Mm-hmm. So, and the new voter law that we're putting into place does not take care of that.
Well, the new voter ID law really doesn't address anything to do with the security of the voter registration system. And that's where all of the voter so you come in to vote. There'll either be a paper record, or now Iowa's most of the counties have moved to electronic poll books. So there's a record of who is registered to vote in that particular precinct. If your name does not appear on that election roll roster, then you're going to have to do something called election day registration, which is a time-consuming effort, especially compared to just walking in, acknowledging that you're registered to vote, showing your ID, and then, or in this case, this year, taking an oath, signing in, getting the ballot, voting. So you have to go through this other process where you actually have to, if it's election day registration and you're not on the voter list, then you have to show your ID, prove who you are, prove where you live.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, in the last 2 minutes, your message for two people. The first, what is your message at this time for Iowa's Secretary of State, Paul Pate? In fact, he'll be on this program on Thursday. What do you want to drive home most?
I want to drive home that great that you're doing all this training and showing people what they should be doing, but you need to, unfortunately, tell the county auditors that there are minimum requirements to hook up to the voter registration system in this state, and that you need to meet those requirements before this election. And that requires that you operate with a sense of urgency to get connected to that system and have your software and hardware monitored, or prove that it is at a level that is equal to or better to what the state is offering, so that we know that at least our first line of defense is in place in time for the November 6th general election.
Mm-hmm. Why would there be any problem with that demand?
Well, because there's a reluctance, I think, to tell people to do that, because if you tell people to do that it becomes an unfunded mandate. And those are two trigger words in local government, state government, where people like, oh, you're telling us to do it, but you're not giving us any money.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a responsibility of the counties to ensure that the election system, which is critical infrastructure as designated by the federal government, is protected. And I believe the Secretary of State has the authority via administrative rules to require that. He is requiring some other things, supposedly, of us in order to hook up to the voter registration system. Why not take that last step? But not just take the last step and tell us that needs to happen. actually get out to the counties and ensure that it did happen.
Okay.
That's what they need, is the resources to get out there, get the software, get the hardware installed, and ensure that at least we've done everything we could up to that point to safeguard the elections infrastructure that we're going to use in November 6th.
Okay, Joel, we only have 30 seconds for this answer, but we really need to address anybody who might be listening who says, oh, I just don't trust elections, that my vote will be counted. I hear so much in the news about hacking and so forth. What do you say to these people who say, you know, not going out because I'm not confident of the vote?
Well, the votes have always been counted. There'll be a record, a paper record of your vote. It'll be there for that record is maintained for a pretty long time. So we can always confirm that vote counted. So get out there and vote. Don't make excuses. Vote, and we'll take care of the rest.
Joel Miller, Linn County Auditor, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Joel Miller, Linn County Auditor, and also with us this hour, I want to say goodbye to Doug Jacobson, Director of the Information Assurance Center at Iowa State University. Thanks for your expertise this hour, Doug.
Hey, you're welcome. Enjoyed the show.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help from Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.